Good evening. This is RCFB Talk 23. My name is Bob Akayeri, and we are out here live, and we want to hear from you. Let's talk college football, whatever topics you want to voice on. We'd love to hear from you. We try to do these every Tuesday. This is our evening where both my colleagues, my normal co-hosts, are on vacation, so it's just me. But I do want to hear from you. If you'd like to chat, just go ahead and hit a request. We want to hear from you, hear what you have to say about what's going on. It can be fun. It can be silly. It can be pertinent. Heck, if you have some hoops stuff you want to talk about, we'll listen to that too, although I don't know how much I can give an input. Although one question that was offered up was whether if you could take any NCAA basketball team right now in the tournament and suit them up as a football team, who would do best? So, I mean, that would be the best way, I guess, perhaps, to bring those together. Another one, and I was looking at what some of the more popular topics had been on RCFB this week, was what was your most embarrassing college football story? So if you want to share that, if you're brave enough to, we'd love to hear from that. I think a lot of folks have probably had moments where they did something. I mean, one of the more popular comments, and this one amused me, was Bax 501, a Kentucky fan, who shared, "We were up 21-3 on Louisville, and their starting QB got injured. I recall saying something along the lines of, 'Here comes the backup scrub. We've got this one locked up.' The scrub was Lamar Jackson, and I still haven't lived that one down." So if you have a story of embarrassment as a college football fan, we'd love to hear that, or just about anything else. Another person, Soka Sport, said, "I told Adrian Peterson that he looked like Adrian Peterson at the store." Again, I could see that one being embarrassing. I've heard Tony Hawk's really famous for that. A lot of people go up to Tony Hawk, the real Tony Hawk, and say, "You look a lot like Tony Hawk." And he says he's been told that many times and never owns up to actually being that guy. Some people have been caught blasting the F-bomb on television and had their parents tell them. But if there's anything from the college football universe you want to talk about, feel free to send a request. We'd love to hear from you. Other issues in the news. I mean, one of those fun stories, again, on the lighter side, is a lot of people sharing that house that Lincoln Riley is supposedly purchased in Los Angeles, the new USC head coach. I mean, dropped a pretty penny for it, $17.2 million, but this is LA for oceanfront property. 7 bedrooms, 12 bathrooms, 5-car garage, elevators, 7 fireplaces, which, as you know, in LA, when it drops below 60 degrees, you're going to need a fireplace because it's got a movie theater, tennis court, putting green, sauna and steam room, 600 bottle wine room, guest house, and again, an ocean view. One of the more popular responses to that, both on Twitter and on RCFB, has been, I guess that would be a reason why he may not have wanted to stay in Norman, although I can think of other reasons. Certainly for that kind of money, you could probably build something much bigger, not necessarily with an ocean view, in the fine town of Norman or nearby. But certainly that's one of those items that's been out there. You know, and we've mentioned this before. We don't know what happened, but Lincoln Riley blocked us on Twitter. We can't figure that one out. We don't typically go after head coaches. We haven't ever gone after him, although we did share a moment on another Reddit, part of Reddit called Our Food, which is about food. And someone had shared a picture of that infamous brisket that looked absolutely dry and miserable that he had cooked as an example of terrible brisket. I don't think anyone really even knew who they were referring to when they shared that particular brisket photo, because people, you know, normal people aren't necessarily as knowledgeable about the cooking habits of college football players, or for me, college football coaches. But maybe he saw that. Maybe he thought we made that comment and blocked us. We can't quite figure it out. But hopefully, you know, we'll see. We've never – the only other coach that ever blocked us was – oh, gosh. And he unblocked us, too, was Petrino. He blocked us because we had pointed out that at some point someone using his account – we forgot how we found this out. Somebody mentioned this, but – you can see what a coach likes, and he had been liking some really strange soft core stuff. And we played a little bit with that. This is years and years ago. And so he blocked anyone who had mentioned that had happened. But we hadn't done anything that in a while, and so that was another interesting moment with that. But again, if you want to talk college football, if you want to say whatever, what's on your mind, we want to hear from you, hit that request. We'll let you up. My name is Bob Akairi. I'm one of the team here at RCFB. My co-hosts who are typically up here are unfortunately out of town and on their vacation. One of them is in Alaska right now. No good college football up there yet. The other big news of this week, the one that did a lot on RCFB and was kind of amusing, but at the same time, kind of sad at the same time. West Point, you probably saw some of the Army football players were six spring breakers who overdosed, so not really funny, but on fentanyl-laced cocaine in the front yard of their Florida vacation home. And two of those apparently who hadn't taken the drugs had suffered a medical crisis when they gave their friends mouth to mouth. So it's scary. It's wild. I mean, we hope they're all okay. I mean, that was a few days ago. I admit I haven't followed up on it. But then again, one of the more shocking stories in the offseason. Hopefully, those guys are feeling fine. Another story, again, sort of a sadder story, one that I know has been, I wouldn't say controversial, because I think it's only controversial with people who really shouldn't be given a voice. And that's the concern over one of the former Michigan players, former NFL player, John Vaughn, was going to chain himself last weekend to a tree at the interim university president's house to protest the abuse he suffered at the hands of former university physician Robert Anderson and other victims of doctors at the University of Michigan who were athletes were and non-athletes were going to join him there. One of the things that struck me about the protest he was doing is he said he was going to chain himself to the tree for 17 and a half hours. And he came up with that number by 1 minute for every survivor abused at the University of Michigan. And that is a when you put something like that, and there's been a couple of moments I want to say in history where individuals have made protests or made statements that if you took a minute for every victim of something, you would end up with some incredible amount of time. But I thought that was a really striking move by John Vaughn when he was saying that's why he was going to make that effort for 17 and a half hours. I know they've settled on some of the issues picked with Larry Nassar, a different doctor, obviously with the gymnastics team and a convicted sexual predator. The physician who John Vaughn was abused by passed away, I believe, in 2008 without any kind of justice. So I know that's been a matter of controversy, particularly whether the coaches at the football team are aware of it. Certainly, there has been accusations by the son of Bo Schembechler, by Bo, and whether Bo knew. I know they've attacked the statue with paint, so that has been an issue of notoriety. I know there have been some within the Michigan family, notoriously Desmond Howard, who have been kind of mum on that, came up during his AMA. And I know a lot of people were less than impressed by the answer he gave on such a hot topic. I know that can be kind of a complicated thing for players and their former coaches, particularly if they weren't subject to what was going on and what someone like Mr. Vaughn has said happened. Again, we're not just talking about that. If you want to talk about anything college football, it can be interesting, can be light. You could maybe go back to the humorous topic we had last week of if you could take a Twitter account, take him over for just one tweet and tweet out something to cause the most chaos in the college football universe, what account would you use and what tweet would you make? That's another suggestion in addition to, what was your most embarrassing college football moment or anything you'd like to talk about. We'd love to hear from you. Just hit request. I will let you up and we'll hear from you. Other topics have been hitting really, I mean, Texas and Alabama fans are not thrilled about the heat for a Fox Noon, big noon kickoff game in Austin in the early season. I know we talked a bit about that game last week, just with fans wondering if what it would take for Texas to establish progress under Steve Sarkisian against Alabama. Obviously, beating them would be the obvious answer, but assuming Alabama's coming off of, of being the runner-up in a national championship game, and they're still Alabama, and they still have Nick Saban as their coach. The odds are they're going to still be likely to win, if not, outright favored in every possible manner. But how much progress would Texas have to show in that game? That has also been a question, and I know there were some thoughts on that. Excuse me, and whether or not Alabama, whether or not Texas would be backing up. But certainly, I know a lot of their fans are not thrilled. I mean, anyone who's been to Texas that time of year knows exactly how hot it's going to be. So it's not going to give Texas a home field advantage because it's not like Tuscaloosa's any cooler at the beginning of the season. But yeah, one of the more popular comments from our users, not Streamer Ninja, are they trying to kill the players with heat stroke? Noon in Austin, who came up with this? I'd say it'd be more worried for the fans at that game. As someone said, preemptively pouring out one for those whose only hydration is frat water. May Powerade hydrate your thirsty souls. Another popular topic, and there's been a couple of variations of this. People have been joking around, could someone explain the downfall of X team? And sometimes you tend to see these trends, but one of the more popular ones was, could someone explain the downfall of Alabama football? And this is purely tongue in cheek, folks. Please do not think I am claiming that Alabama is on the downswing. But some folks are trying to come up with possibilities. Well, in about 2014, Colin Cowherd noticed that Alabama had a Nick Saban problem. They have never fixed this problem, so they've only won 43% of their national championships since, which I guess the numbers don't lie there. That's only 43% of the national championships that they've played in since 2014. Moving on. And again, if you want to chime in about anything college football, we'd love to hear from you. One of the other moments, and this was one of the more popular topics for the RCFB community in this past week, was an odd statement by Auburn football. Not odd, but one of those things where you just get worried that are you really willing to risk the amount of heat you're going to get if this does not go exactly as planned? But the Auburn Twitter account put out a and they literally wrote the tweet, put the word out there with a something on the Auburn letterhead, and all it says, the following statement was released today by Auburn football across all social media platforms and directly from the Auburn Athletics facility in response to rumors surrounding spring practice. Quote unquote, "We're back." That the I if you're an if you're a fan of Auburn, that's cool. Hopefully everything works out for you. If you are not the biggest fan of the Auburn University football team and they've fall behind in any sense of the way, I certainly could imagine the "we're back" is going to come back to haunt them. One of the more infamous moments I can recall, at least in, there's been several, but one of the ones I remember in Los Angeles was when UCLA hired Rick Neuheisel when they first hired him, and they were really thrilled because he had had a successful career at Washington, and he had to leave because of he was in a college basketball betting pool, and that was, remember how hard ass the NCAA could be. They pushed him out over that, and he was in Washington football really suffered afterwards. So when UCLA hired him after he'd been in the after he'd been a commentator for a few years, they were really excited. They thought, this is it. He's an alum. He's going to make everything great again in Westwood. And obviously, UCLA had Pete Carroll, so they were hoping to get some excitement. They published this big ad about talking about how great things are going to be. Football is back. Football is here. The power in Los Angeles is over here. And then it just never worked out. So that ad got completely rejiggered in a bajillion ways to make fun of UCLA and the Rick Neuheisel era. So when you see something like Auburn putting out a tweet with "we're back" ahead of a season after we all, I mean, I'm sure many of you remember how chaotic it was just a couple of months ago with the controversy of whether they were going to push Harsin out. Certainly, You're setting yourselves up for something. I mean, maybe that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to galvanize the fan base after that whole fiasco over whether or not they were going to retain Harsin when you got the sense that there was a portion of the establishment at Auburn trying to put stories out there to get him out. So maybe they're trying to get past that. I don't know if this would be the way to do it, but certainly it got a lot of humor out of it. Another, again, if you want to talk about anything college football and you want to have your voice up here, we'd love to hear from you. Please just hit a request. We'll let you up. I'd love to talk to you. We'd love to hear from you. Another topic that got some interest from folks on our CFB was, oh, hey, we got a request. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and let you up, Miller. Let's see here. Thank you for being brave. We'd love to hear from you. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, as always, fire Mike Norvell. I just want to say I'm impressed with how long you could go without anyone else talking. That's a talent, so good for you.
Thanks.
But as far as college football, with the recent round of realignment, for the next round, who do you think are some group of five teams that are potential candidates to move up to Power Five?
That is a great question. And it's what makes it interesting to me is you tend to look at teams like 10 years ago. I don't know if I would have get, and that's I think maybe a little too far back to go, but there's some teams I wouldn't have necessarily guessed. I wouldn't have necessarily guessed Cincy was going to be one of the teams to move up. But as far as programs that I think are trying to position themselves, you start to wonder like which universities could command a market. And I think TV markets to some extent play a factor in it. And it's interesting to say this because as small, relatively speaking, as the state of Utah's market is, and I'm not talking about BYU because they're a bit of a special thing because obviously they have that their whole LDS church thing around them, and so their fans are drawn a little broader, a little bit like Notre Dame, although not quite at the level of Notre Dame. But when the Pac-12 was expanding, part of the reason they picked Utah, and I mean obviously they picked Colorado, but they picked Utah because they thought there was some benefit to getting the Salt Lake City market. So a lot of this, when you're trying to predict what football programs are going to move up or get picked to move up. You want to look at what teams kind of bring in a market and what teams can afford to also put in the amount of funding it would take to build facilities, to develop what it would take to step up to that next level. So again, a team like Houston makes sense. I mean, obviously, back in the day, they were an equivalent of a Power Five program before the Southwest Conference broke up. And they started to pour more money into the program. They're a big public university, so they could get some funds. When you have a student body in like the 40,000 range, that gives you, it's sad to say this, but you can pull some money off your students. So, and they're obviously in the Houston market. So that at least made some sense. Now, their rival in the same city, Rice, and academically a powerhouse, but it's a small school. They certainly famously Rice Stadium was always just this gigantic overbuilt facility. They were also a Southwest Conference team, but I don't think realistically they would be have ever been as desirable in a position like that. You could say the same thing of why you would pull up while you consider pulling up a program like Southern Methodist. So with that said, if I'm looking at Florida, because Florida to me is obviously a spot where lots of large universities in major metropolitan areas, UCF being the one that has been selected to move up. USF, I think they really do want to put themselves in a position because certainly, again, I mean, I'm old enough to have been. I mean, I remember that 2007 season. It feels like it was yesterday, and then I realized it was such a long time ago. But I remember when the Bulls made it up to the second spot for a brief moment. And I think at that moment, everyone thought, wow, they're going to be, if there's going to be another round of expansion, they would be the team. And then they fell by the wayside. They had lots of issues. I think they with finding a solid coach that would stay or win consistently. But now, you look at what they're doing. They're doing, by the way, one of the best stadium approaches to building a new stadium that I've seen. It's very methodical in all the right ways. They give an update right on schedule. Like, we're thinking about building a stadium, and in about, however many months, like in 6 months, we're going to have a list of possible sites. 6 months later, we have a list of possible sites. We've put it before the Board of Regents, whatever their equivalent is of the Board of Regents, and we've been allowed to then pick the best of the five sites. So, like, I think it was last week, they announced we found a site that we think is going to work. They've tweeted it. We tweeted. I actually redid their campus map and even pointed exactly where this thing would fit on their campus. And they were willing to build a brand new stadium. And next to it, they apparently had already planned an indoor practice facility. So when you look at that, when you look at, and also, I mean, USF, I have to look that up. I mean, they're an enormous campus. They, sorry, I don't have their numbers in front of me. But, a lot of students, a lot of money potentially to, 50,000 students. I forgot. They're one of the biggest. I mean, UCF. I remember when I was in, God, it makes me sound old, but when I was in graduate school, they weren't the number one. They're like, they weren't near being the number one school in terms of total student body. But now I think they are number one. They've got like 68,000, 70,000 students at UCF. So again, there's a lot of money, even putting a little bit of a student fee, you can generate a lot of money in a hurry. While, the same conference, you've got Tulsa, which has got 3,000 students, and it's amazing that they can even field an FBS program. But so South Florida, they got 50,000 students. They've clearly got a budget in mind. They want to build an on-campus stadium. They want to pour into that market. They're in, a pretty decent location with the Tampa market, so they could pull that kind of an audience. So if they start making some moves, I think, especially with the product on the field, I could see them being a desirable program to move up. You could say the same thing potentially about Memphis. I think Memphis is interesting because they've never been thrilled with the Liberty Bowl, and they've always occasionally talked about building an on-campus stadium, and they have a lot of support from the city of Memphis. But Memphis has always been kind of an in-betweener city in terms of getting interest. Obviously, Memphis basketball has gone through moments of being incredible, and I mean, I still. Excuse me, the perils of talking nonstop. But they certainly could. I know they have a lot of push from local folks, especially, obviously, I know that FedEx guy loves that university. So they would be one. I know, now, as far as teams that just continually want to move up, I mean, every G5 in the heart of hearts wants to move up. And another team that constantly pushes is East Carolina. I don't know if they pull enough to the table to do so. But they've always been very aggressive with wanting to move up. Now, I'm not going to say much about teams in the MAC. They just really are. With teams in the MAC, you're usually just hoping they don't lose football. And I'm looking at Akron when I say that. Akron moved up. They were the last member of the MAC to move up to FBS football. And they've looked uncomfortable in that position ever since. Another team that could theoretically be desirable, although I don't know if the market would be too saturated, would be North Texas, but I would be hesitant to say that. I want to see a lot more there, but they're obviously in the Metroplex. A lot of good football there, a lot of interest there. I don't know if UAB would, because I mean, Birmingham is a solid metropolitan area. Obviously, they're extremely football hungry in the state of Alabama, but I mean, they might be a little taxed there, and I would say that for other programs in some of the southern states where they already have dominant teams, particularly with the SEC and the ACC in some cases. The Sun Belt, a lot of those programs, I mean, they're Texas State theoretically is on the bigger side, and I could see that, but I would doubt it. Georgia State's a big student body. But I don't know if they would ever get that kind of commitment with obviously Georgia and Georgia Tech and an equally, aggressive Georgia Southern in Statesboro. It's not a major metropolitan area, but I mean, there's a lot of football played there. I don't know if they could ever pull enough to move up. And, in honor of my host who's out of town right now, I'm sure Vanderbilt would love to be considered a P5 team. Sorry. But Miller, who do you think? I mean, who do you think you'd like to see move up? I kind of went through some of my thoughts on that.
Just running through some of the teams you said, I could see SMU being a candidate. I think TCU being in a similar DFW Metroplex kind of hurts them. They kind of already have the market. And having been to an SMU game, there's just not a ton of support for their football team. The stadium was about half empty. Houston, definitely. I'm almost surprised they haven't yet. I didn't think of those things about USF, but I could definitely see it. I'd almost put Eastern Carolina as a third option within the state of North Carolina. I think Charlotte's better positioned as far as the market. It's just if they perform better, they'll get more interest. And then Appalachian's been a better football team than them for since they've been FBS. I think Memphis would definitely be a good one.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think, and with ECU in particular, they've always just been aggressive about it. I remember the first time the Big 12 said we're taking applications, and ECU couldn't get their application in fast enough. They were like, we will take, we will go. So that's why ECU tends to, I think, and Memphis to an extent, tend to go harder than people expect, because their administrations are like just ready to leap on any opportunity that arises. While some programs, again, like USF, you sense that they're kind of building a case for themselves. But yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think App State's a stronger football team. I think the problem is they're just so new on the block. I think SMU, and it's funny you mentioned SMU, I think SMU and Rice were the two former members of the Southwest Conference that just kind of never really just don't feel like they've quite got. And I mean, don't get me wrong, the program on the field of SMU in recent years has been solid. There's no doubt about that. But at least the way their support has been put in the shadow of their rivals who were also in the old Southwestern Conference, TCU and Houston, who instead have taken that pole position to be the teams in those two enormous metropolitan areas to move up and rejoin and be in the Big 12. Because I remember TCU, gosh, in the 90s, that was a crazy thought to think they could ever get to where they are now and be a solid contender in the Big 12 again, because they had kind of fallen. I mean, they were a whack team. I still remember when they upset a really mediocre USC team in the Sun Bowl in 98. So now that wouldn't be a shocker at all. You'd expect TCU to upset any USC team at this point.
Yeah. Shout out Gary.
Yeah, now we'll see how that he does in Texas. I still can't get over seeing him in Texas outfits. That's wild to me. What's your team?
Appalachian.
Yeah, fine program. I mean, I know we've talked about it before, so now that you mention it. So
a little bit of a small budget to move up. I've heard him talk about wanting to go to the ACC, but budget's too small. They've already got a ton of teams within North Carolina. I think a better conference for them would be the American.
I think that seems to be the vector for programs that want to kind of move. I mean, they always like to say they're the P6, you know, to try and include themselves. But if anything, they're like the transitional conference. Like you move up to the American just to prove that you can get close enough to get that brass ring, and then one of the other conferences in the P5 will send you that invite. And as committed as they sound to the American, the moment they get that invite, they don't look back. And yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, one thing is for sure, I don't think anyone can question how prepared App State was to move up to FBS. I mean, everyone was expecting to be competitive, but I mean, they have been an absolute, you know, perfect fit for FBS football and done nothing but, you know, be a thorn in the side of anybody who faces them in the Sun Belt. So I think that's been just a lovely thing to see.
Yeah. Speaking of them moving up, what do you think about the NCAA's dead period rule, where I forget how many years it is, but when a team transitions between FCS and FBS or even Division II to Division I, where they can't compete in the postseason?
I think it's nonsense. I really do. You know, one of the ways the NAIA, and I know some of you know it, it's that it's another it's parallel with the NCAA. It's sort of it's somewhere between Division II and Division III, and I could get into the reasons why. They used to have two divisions, but they merged them. So you have some teams that have scholarships that are close to D2 level, some that don't. But a way they were kind of luring teams that wanted to go there, one of their incentives was if you transferred your team from NCAA to NAIA, you could immediately play in the playoffs. And if you formed a team, you could immediately qualify for the playoffs, which the way they lure teams is they offer a lower they offer a cheaper cost of operation. They're leaner. You don't have to have as many employees in your athletic department if you're in the NAIA. And you might say, like, well, that won't make a difference when you're talking about D1. Of course, it doesn't make a difference. But if you're a struggling D2 program and you might have a bunch of teams in your region, they tend to be in the Midwest, you might join an NAIA program. But that said, I think the NCAA rule is stupid. And they know that rule is stupid. That's why the NAIA made that rule. Because I think if a team wins on the field, and obviously, if they're playing a transitional schedule where, a third to a half of the teams are like D2 teams still, because that sometimes happens if they're transferring up and transfer, then okay, I could see that that schedule might not quite be right. But I think if a team has moved up to FBS from FCS or from D2 to FCS, they should, if they get win on the field against the right kind of competition, there's no reason why they shouldn't get that bid. I think it's a stupid rule. I mean, a shocker there, right? An NCAA having a stupid rule. Whoever saw that one
Yeah,
coming?
of course.
I'm surprised they don't get rid of that. Of all the things people get angry about, constantly angry about with the NCAA, why can't they just eliminate that one? I mean, I guess to some extent, there is a lot of, and I'll say this, with the NCAA, you always have to remember they've got what, like 3,000 members. It's not all, football schools, let alone, the top schools. So they get, I think, pressure on both sides. They get pressure from people who are like in the programs in D2, their presidents or athletic directors say, we don't want to lose more teams. It's killing our conferences. We're gonna, we don't want to see this, rush of everyone up. And then the teams obviously don't want to share more of the pie on the higher levels. So they want to create, you really want it kind of a moment there. So I think perhaps that is coming into play why these rules get created. It's not, an NCAA president sitting there laughing and twiddling their mustache and thinking of all the evil things they could do. I think there is a little bit more real politic going on there with the two sides, who has something to lose on both sides of that. But certainly, I mean, we've seen what's, but the conferences can be, little, nightmares on themselves. I mean, just look at the whole fiasco with the Colonial and James Madison, how they were telling them they couldn't, compete in certain postseason events. And, there's so much self-interest, so much, I mean, when it boils down to it, it's money, obviously. I mean, just watching those series of lawsuits between the Conference USA and its soon to be former members, it tells you everything. It's about jockeying for position. It's about, it's business and business law. I remember when we a few weeks ago had Professor Michael McCann, the sports law person. I remember I even posed him the question from my own background as an attorney. I'm like, yeah, I'm reading these the news summary of this attempt by, a school to sue Conference USA and a Conference USA to sue a school. I mean, I look past all the obvious sports, commentary. To me, it's like these are two entities that are just trying to get the most out of a settlement. This is pure, at its core, this is just legal tactics. And it the color the flavor of this ice cream, and I wouldn't say it's anything like ice cream, but the flavor of this particular ice cream is sports. But it's still ice cream, and that's what was going on there. But yeah. So anyway, I really appreciate that. That's a nice topic to get onto. You absolutely hit on one of my least favorite things, and that rule is, if I were the NCAA, I would just get rid of that rule, and I think it would please people, and then they'll not hate you for like 48 hours at least, or maybe less.
Yeah, for sure.
Wait.
It was just on my mind. One of my friends is a athlete at Lindenwood, and they're moving up from D2. He took
Yeah, and
third
I
at
saw that.
Nationals 2 or 3 years ago. It was the year before COVID.
Yeah.
Redshirted the COVID year, got an extra year of eligibility, hurt his shoulder this year, and got a medical redshirt. So he's gonna get a chance to get a national title next year. And now that they're moving up, he doesn't even have the opportunity.
So, and does he feel the trade-off with playing, more D1 programs is not worth it in his mind? He would just rather kind
No,
of.
I mean, he started out at Division One school and then transferred D2. And since
Oh,
they can't
got it.
compete in the postseason, they're just going to compete as a club team.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it's for like 4 years, so it really just handicaps the program and takes away any momentum they have going Division One.
That could I
So,
and that must that's really disappointing for him. I'm sorry to hear that. It
yeah.
is funny. I always, when you hear some of these stories, I always wonder about the players that get stuck in those transitions. One of the stranger ones was when I think it was I forget it was Campbell, the Camels were going from they were going from the Pioneer Football League, I believe. So they were non-scholarship FCS, and they were moving to scholarship. So in order to make that work, they were letting in two different pro they let in two different classes of scholarship players, but didn't field them. So they actually took all these players and said, like, you're not going to play on the field because we're still in the Pioneer Football League. And that was the agreement that came with it. And so all these players came in and they still played. But I'm wondering, what was that transition like for the guys who were on the team, who are still playing, knowing that they're all being basically replaced completely? And I think there was a transition there where they still had a few, classes worth of non-scholarship guys, but all their scholarship replacements were ready to go, so that you had this really awkward transition for a couple of seasons. So I always wonder what it's like for the players in those circumstances. But thanks for joining us, Miller. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, man, thanks. Hey, Adam, I just let you up as well. I'd love to hear from you. Feel free to hit unmute, bottom left. There you go.
Gotcha. Yeah, sorry. No, I've been listening, and I think something else that I've heard talked about as far as conference realignment and everything is with the NIL deal that everybody's seeing and the Power Five being able to offer guys obviously some more money, and you were just hitting on it with market teams. It's really becoming where colleges can now market themselves for being in a Houston and things like that, in big market cities. Like I think Miller said, Charlotte is a great location. He's correct. I think a lot of these schools, and what I've heard, and what I'm getting to here is that the Power Fives will eventually become the lawmakers of what is allowable, from the NCAA. And so the NCAA will not so much govern them. They'll kind of just say, hey, things are fair for this level. And then what I think will actually happen is going to, you talk about some of those other schools, the Sun Belt, the group of six schools, the American, some of those schools will go technically Power Five, where, you might have a roster with a salary cap, effectively, instead of, and I heard you talk about the NAIA and some things like that, Division Twos. Effectively, it all comes down to money. And from, for example, the FCS, most schools allow a certain amount of scholarships. So, for instance, if you have a tuition cost of, let's say $10,000 for the low end, FCSs that are scholarship can cut up those dollar amounts, and they can stack it with academic money. So, if you have somebody that gets $5,000 in academic money, that means the athletic department or the football team can cut a check for 5,000. and not have to pay the full cost of tuition and everything else, right? So that's kind of what I've heard as far as transitioning is you're going to see the Power Fives truly become, hey, you know, we're going to have our full allotted amount of scholarships in the form of not NIL deals, but hey, you're going to get paid this amount of money and it's going to probably cover the cost of your tuition, the cost of everything, the cost of whatever you sign for, probably have a signing bonus, you know, things like that is what's, I think, what I've heard could happen in that 10-year span, like you were talking about. Cause I remember it too, you know, when the WAC was the WAC and you had, you know, TCU and some of those other schools in it, you could see that, you know, there are some schools that are just in different locations. You know, you have teams like the Hawaii, and I was just looking on here not too long ago that, you know, the Colt Brennan and everything that they're doing in Hawaii this coming up weekend, I think.
Yep, with his memorial. Spread his ashes on, I think, off the shore of Waikiki, as I recall.
Yes, which is awesome. But I'm sure you know, you remember whenever they played Georgia, and you know, some of those schools that, you know, it's awesome. And really, I love the BCS model because it at least gave an option for those types of teams to kind of get in. Now it all also went back to strength of schedule. But what I'm getting to is the transition is going to be where the Power Fives say, all right, it's going to be, you know, a 60, you know, take the Power Five and maybe a couple other schools and divide it regionally or northwest, east, south, whatever you might want to call it, and make divisions, and it'll be 10, 12, you know, maybe 14 team playoff, where the top, you know, 14 out of 34 or 32, 34, you know, somewhere in that middle range. You know, not like basketball where, you know, if you got to be in the top 50 to get in, you get in. But where they're going to be able to play, you know, and make money like March Madness is doing right now and get guys in there. And then what will happen with the other schools. So I know I heard Vanderbilt get brought up. Vanderbilt's going to get probably choose to go down. And like you said earlier, Rice being academically and, you know, the Stanfords of the world, the other academic schools that may not want to push being athletically focused like they could be. You'll see those teams differentiate in how they approach that transition. So there might be, you know, still playing, you know, division number levels relevant because they're all going to play each other, I think, still, but the type of money that goes into the program is going to be what's the difference. So
I think you brought up some great points there throughout that. Because, I mean, one of the questions, I think, before NIL became became really even a thing, to be entirely honest, was whether or not you were going to see not just the P5, but the best of the P5 form. I don't know why they kept calling it this because it sounded like a misnomer, but they called it Division 4. They should just call it a fourth division because, you know, it doesn't make sense. D3 is, you know, not moving down, but it's a total opposite side of the scale where it's non-scholarship. But there was a move, you know, or at least a hypothetical Division 4 that's been discussed. And I don't think it was just an academic discussion. I think there was a serious question of whether you were going to see the best of the P5, at least the best being relative, but the most financially well-funded. So that would probably mean programs like Vanderbilt or Wake Forest or teams that just couldn't necessarily compete with the really big, well-funded FBS programs would kind of move off and then create their own special rules because the rules, the reason that, and some people argue maybe that's what led to the NIL. Being the rules being established the way they were, because there was a lot of pressure from the very top programs that they were being somewhat handcuffed by the rules that were set to even the playing field between, you know, Louisiana Tech, which is one of the most financially tight programs there is, or Louisiana Monroe and LSU or Alabama or Notre Dame, where the money is just at a whole other stratosphere. And so now you're right, with the NIL, it seems to have pushed this question. So are we going to see these sort of super conferences, whether they divide in a geographic way, like you've suggested? Certainly that's been a model that's been bandied about. But will we see that? And it's interesting because there was actually a topic today on RCFB where people were talking, and it was kind of a, I don't know if everyone would agree with it, but so one guy had asked, you know, does anyone feel like they're slowly falling out of love with college football? And he, you know, admits that he wasn't trying to be like overly reactionary or a prisoner of the moment, but he felt like the nature of the sport had changed because of the NIL and how it's removed a lot of the regionality and local identity, because now obviously you've seen players transferring it. I think that's, by the way, I'm not criticizing that. I think the ability of players to transfer more readily via the portal is actually good for them, because their coaches could at any given moment. And I think to an extent, it's always a shame when you realize there had been an amazing player at a program who, for whatever reason, wasn't being used right, or you know, for whatever reason, was just locked in a situation that wasn't great and wanted that opportunity to perhaps move if college football was their main focus in their life. And I mean, I'm not blaming them, but I mean, so you kind of want to see them have that ability. But with the NIL, this person was saying that it made it kind of a pro sports league without a salary cap. And I see why you're suggesting perhaps we're in a cap, because we are really in that moment of it being the Wild West right now.
Without a doubt. And I think what's going to go on, like, you know, this is me forecasting. I don't think this will happen in the next 5 years. But I would almost guarantee that if the NCAA and our good old boy Mark Emmert ever steps down, that whoever takes over is going to be tasked with that, on defining and deciding, hey, you know, guys in you know, the big money making sports, you know, what kind of rules do you want to follow? And so
exactly. And I love the way you phrase that, because that's it. It's, what do you guys want to do? Because you all set the rules. Mark Emmert has paid a lot of money to be the punching bag for what all the universities are actually wanting. And I mean, it's like that's why people will sometimes get that mistake with the commissioners in the pro leagues. It's like, no, all the owners are paying for that guy's salary to stand up there and say things that are going to piss off fans. And then he's the punching bag, not the team owners, or in this case, the universities. So you're absolutely right when you phrase it that way. Whoever is going to try and corral this is going to have to ask all of these programs, like, you know, cool, we probably want to put a cap on this somewhere, or do you want one? And if you, what would you be willing to agree to? It's almost as chaotic as trying to get countries to agree on something in the UN. And I don't say that because of what's going on in geopolitics. Actually, not to nerd out, but I studied the UN in college, and that was sort of the thing. It's like the UN, people don't realize, like, the UN, it's like, no, you got to get all the countries to agree to it, especially if they're on the Security Council. And that's kind of like what we have here. We have a bunch of universities that got to agree to it. Otherwise, the NCAA can't really just force it as much as some folks have wanted to. So, you know, they're the ones that are the haves. We really appreciate it, Adam. Thank you for all that input.
Hey, no problem.
Thanks. Hey, Dylan, I'm letting you up and love to hear from you. I know you've been patient. I do love hearing from as many of you as we can. Feel free to chat me up. What's going
on?
Hey,
man. So I had a quick question about the transfer portal. So players that are on the transfer portal that are trying to look to go to a D1 school, obviously I think it's D1 schools have 25 scholarship offers for players, but let's say most of these teams run out of scholarships, and then there's always these players that are on the transfer portal. What do you think will happen to these transfer portal kids? Will they go to HBCUs, or are they going to be forced to go to FCS or D2 or D3 schools, or what do you think is going to happen?
Well, some folks can just return back to the school. Right? Just because you enter the portal doesn't mean you leave. So to some extent, the portal can't spit you back out. at your school, and sometimes, you know, the programs will decide to stay, the guys will decide to stay. But, no, you're right. It is kind of creates an interesting open market. I don't know why I thought of, like, that Dr. Pepper commercial where the punter comes out of the transfer portal and they're like, oh, no, we're good. Adam, did you want to say something? I just saw you on mute. Please feel free to...
I did. So you were kind of asking about the whole scholarships. And this is tying back to what we were just talking about as far as scholarship numbers and everything like that. Like, you guys gotta understand, and I was a former Division I FCS graduate assistant, so I understood, I think I understand this at a little bit higher level. Currently unemployed football coach, at least that's what I try to be. But basically what you have to understand is those kids, like, for instance, Williams that just transferred to follow his boy Riley out there to USC, and some of the other guys that have gone into the portal, football coaches and football programs, you know, at the Division I FBS level, those guys have, what, 83 scholarships? You can fill a team out that should be fairly decent, compete day in, day out, at least not, you know, maybe not in the SEC. SEC probably uses 63 of those scholarships, but you're going to have plenty of scholarships. That's why the thing that everybody loves is, you know, preseason or getting into postseason is the coaches always put out a, hey, you've earned a scholarship. That most schools have extra scholarships to what they need, or they know, hey, you know, we got John whoever who is a graduate or going to graduate and going to come off the books in December. Well, we can officially offer this kid a scholarship, and whenever that league year starts or whatever, we can put him on scholarship. You know what I'm saying? So,
but I think what Dylan was talking about was like the 25, go, you know, the yearly 25.
Yeah. From what I've heard is there's more players on the transfer portal than there is scholarships to give away to players.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting. Correct. Yeah, exactly. So the total number in the transfer portal right now is more than all the possible scholarships that are available.
Yeah.
So I think we'll probably see are some players that just return to their teams. And I could see that as being what could happen in that particular circumstance. Ed, I don't mind having multiple speakers up here, so I figured I'd let the other guy who has his hand up in too. And I want Dylan, Adam, stay up. There's no problem with that. Love to hear from you both. Solly, I know you've wanted to add something to this.
Yeah, no, definitely. Adam made some great points, but I just want to just kind of like piggyback on what Dylan was saying. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
So Dylan, you know, so there's three major factors that we got to talk about here. So one is the transfer portal. So just to talk about what Dylan is talking about, you know, guys are going to transfer portal. If you can't get out right now, you're stuck. So you're like in this gray area. And now that we're in spring ball on this time period, there's going to be a lot of teams that are overloaded on the roster. So I'm talking about FBS D1 right now. They, because of COVID, they were all given a holdback year, right? So if you got into the transfer portal and you didn't get out for the spring ball, you're stuck. So they got to wait till spring ball to be over, and then D1s will then make cuts in April to the rosters. So then, you know, if they cut, you know, a senior who didn't really play spring ball, now they'll have an offer available, right? So each school is going to be case by case at this point. So there's the transfer portal. You have the holdback year for D1s for every college. And then you have this this whole other freaking monster of an NIL deal on the other side. But the guys who are in transfer portal right now, they're going to be stuck. And if you didn't have a coach already reach out to you to try to recruit you from once you got into transfer portal, you probably won't get out. And then for them to try to go back to the original school, see, once you tell a coach that you're going to transfer out and hit the portal, you lose that scholarship. So for you to think and assume that you're going to be able to go back to that school, you're pretty much asked out, because now that scholarship became open for a possible PWO or a possible another guy on the team to get scholarship that was a original walk-on. So it's a big old clusterfuck right now.
Yeah. Yeah, especially with that number of with that kind of a jam. Dylan, did you want to add something to that?
No, I think he did a good job of just explaining that because it was a little bit confusing. So that kind of makes sense.
Adam, go ahead. I saw you wanted to also chime in. Both of you kind of at the same time. I saw a hand up, and then I saw you unmuted. So I don't want to make either of you guys feel like you're not welcome.
Sorry. Can I just finish up on what Dylan said, Adam?
Sure.
So I have a nephew who's currently stuck in the transfer portal, and it was something that I kind of experienced firsthand. Was I told him when he first went into the portal, I told him, like, look, you have to make sure that you have your bases covered. Make sure that you're talking to another D1 school, and if they have an offer for you, if you don't have that offer, do not go in the fucking portal right now because you're going to get stuck. And you have to make sure that you're communicating with your current coach. Because if things don't work out and you try to come back, that scholarship's not going to be there for you. And that's exactly what happened to him. He had left the school, thought he was going to get picked up in the portal, didn't get picked up. He's been in there for a year and a half now, and tried to go back to the original school. And they told him, hey, look, you told us you're transferring. We don't have that scholarship offer anymore. We already gave it to the 2022 signing class. So he's stuck in the portal now. He's got to wait for this spring ball to end to see if any other rosters get cut. For him to try to get an offer, or he's got to wait for the fall to see if any of the schools have a PWO available or a possible scholarship on hand. Because if you think about it, the D1s have 85 total scholarships. They have to wait for one of those 85 to be taken away because the signing class already had passed by in February.
That's a really interesting. I mean, yeah, wow, that is really complicated. Adam, I know you wanted to add more to this.
Yes. Yeah, so, like I said, you know, for what's being discussed right now. So just like you said, you know, talking to, you said your cousin, I believe.
It was my nephew.
Nephew. Okay. So like I said, I was a Division I FCS grad assistant, and per NCAA rules, you are not allowed to communicate with another coach, right? Until you have been released or officially put into the transfer portal. So here's also where this sidestep goes is most colleges, and I'm going to say every sport, you know, I remember, you know, not myself, but other coaches were getting reached out to. And the answer is always, hey, are you in the portal? Because I cannot talk to you about any scholarships or anything like that until you reach that. So, there's the irony right there is, you know, you always want to have somewhere to go or know where you're going, right? And again, to what I'm saying, what I'm going to say, this part is those high level guys that, you know, I was an elite level, you know, 4-star, 5-star kid. They can jump in the portal and not have to talk to anybody, or, you know, just, you know, shoot the little, you know, winky emoji at a coach and say, hey, I'm coming. What's up? You got a scholarship. And, you know, there can be some nonverbal communication that the NCAA can't catch up on. But
yes, exactly, Adam.
For what everybody else is going through, and I'll say this, I don't think this was discussed. The transfer portal is for everybody, right? So Division III to Division, you know, I and the FBS, FCS is. So you have to realize that there are kids in the transfer portal that are not scholarship kids. Right. And what I loved about the transfer portal originally was it's going to give those guys, you know, like the what's old boy for the Browns, the quarterback, Baker Mayfield that transferred, and some of those other guys that have left schools and transferred, you know, that's given them the opportunity to not have to sit out that next year, which is awesome in my opinion. There's enough scholarships that most schools have. Like I'm going to say this just as a blanket statement that most Division I FBS schools, not saying that they don't have, you know, at least an extra 5 scholarships ready for people, but most of them have at least 2 or 3 tucked away just for anybody that wants to transfer. So I'm saying that to say this, that the transfer portal right now, as far as the rules go and the NCAA with communication, that you have to be in the portal, but you also want to have kids not get stuck, right? Well, they can't get they can't know where they're going until they communicate that, hey, I'm going to the portal, I'm officially in, and all that. So it's just a really sticky situation. And I know you're saying you're a lawyer or studied all that in law and sports law, that there's kind of a sticky situation in there that you can't communicate with a school until you're in it. So you don't know, you know, hey, coach, you know, coach said I'm getting cut, where, you know, cuts are different. Whereas I, if I get cut, I can pick a guy up. But, you know, whenever we start talking scholarship money and all that other stuff and, you know, preferred walk-ons and everything else, it can be a it can be a hassle. And so your nephew might have to say, hey, I might need to look at a FCS or a Division II or whatever level he's at. I might have to go down if I want to and then try and grad transfer up and do all those other things too. So, I mean, what's really turning this this system up is that it's becoming a business and solely a business. So,
you know, and I have to add to that, Adam, that, you know, you obviously pulled on the fact that, you know, my background in legal issues, when it is becoming more of a business, there are more chances for that to come up in some kind of a litigation standpoint. I'm surprised we haven't seen some interesting challenges from players who do get upset. But I mean, I don't know if there's ever enough money at stake, unfortunately, for that to come into play. You know, I really, really appreciate you guys, Adam, Dylan, Solly, for giving us that really interesting discussion there at the end. And I know, Adam, you've got a background there too, with your own coaching background. And it's been about an hour. We typically like to wrap up. I love it. Keep seeing the royal we, because I'm the only one who was here tonight. Again, the other guys did tell me in advance they weren't able to make it. But I just wanted to thank you guys. I'm going to be going ahead and wrapping this up. From all of us at RCFB, and from myself, Bob A. Kyrie, I wanted to thank you all. And we'll be doing this again next Tuesday night. And have a great night. We hope to have you join us again. Take care. If I can
end. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Reddit. Man, I wanted to add in the NIL deal before we closed out.
Yeah, thank you.
I ran into
that. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Finish this up.
I think it was Adam. It might have been Adam, but or maybe it was Dylan. But, you know, the NIL, I feel, gives, you know, the other smaller schools from smaller towns that's Power Five almost like an even keel to with the recruiting game. You know, there's a couple of great examples out there with Arizona. You have Jackson State with Deion Sanders. You know, there's schools that were able to recruit high 4 stars, 5 stars because of the NIL deal. You know, where if it's another year, you know, Arizona, they're never at the top tier of the Pac-12 in the recruiting game, but because of these NIL deals, they are able to land really high touted recruits. And I think that's what.
Well, maybe we'll see. That'll anger enough of the people in charge to cause right. A bit of a pushback on that. Well, on
and
that
I think
note,
it will.
Thank you for giving us that last thought. I'm going to go ahead and close this up. Thank you, guys. And
all right, guys.
Join us next week if you get a chance. It was great.
I definitely will. What time? What time?
We always do them at 10 p.m. Eastern. So.
Got it.
All right. Have a great night, everyone.